We continue this morning in our study of Pirkei Avos, and we are still in the first parak. We are up to Mishnah Vav, where we have here a very important Mishnah. We're going to really focus on the first part of the Mishnah. Perhaps we'll get to the second part next week. So let us just begin. Yehoshua ben Prachya Omer, you have the Mishnah on the very top of the page. Yehoshua ben Prachya taught us, Aseh l'charav, one should always make for themselves a teacher, ukenei l'chachaver, and we should go to great lengths to have good friends. Ve'haveidan es kal ha'adam l'kaf zechus. So there's a lot going on here in this Mishnah, and we don't have enough time to discuss all of it this morning. So we're just going to stick to the first part, Aseh l'charav. But in order to fully appreciate what it is that Rabbi Yehoshua ben Prachya is teaching us, let us just give a little bit of a historical context to who Yehoshua ben Prachya actually was, and why it is perhaps that he chose to teach us this lesson. Rav Soloveitchik writes, and many other Mefarshim say the same idea. Very often in Pirkei Avos you'll find that it says, Hu haya omer. He used to say. So, you know, if you would think about it, we've all had parents or grandparents who had all kinds of sayings and quips and very insightful comments. And if we would write a book of all the things that they said throughout their lifetimes, I'm sure we would have many, many things to record down for future generations. So what does it mean, Hu haya omer? This is all he said? There was nothing else insightful in his entire life that he ever portrayed? This is it? This is the message? So Rav Soloveitchik said that perhaps what it means is, Hu haya omer means his essence said this. He lived his life by this. This is what he represented. And therefore, anyone who came in contact with this person understood that these were the messages that they meant to impart to future generations and to their Talmidim, to their communities. And the same goes with our Mishnah here. Yehoshua ben Prachya teaches us something which obviously was an extremely impactful part of the life that he tried to live. It was obviously a message that was very important to him to transmit to future generations. And the question is, why? Why is it that he chooses these statements? Why is it that he tells us, Aseh l'charav? So let's try to gain an appreciation for what that's all about. The Gemara tells us both in Maseches Sota Daf Mem Zayin, as well as in Sanhedrin Daf Kuf Zayin, the same story, but with details that find themselves mentioned in both of those places a little bit differently. So the Gemara there tells us about Yanai HaMelech, and it seems that Yanai HaMelech was a madman. It seems that he was just totally irrational, totally crazy, and he just woke up on the wrong side of the bed and decided to destroy the Chachmei Yisrael. He decided that he wanted to destroy all of the leaders of the Jewish community, and so he did. And he wiped out, pretty much, he eliminated all of the Talmidei Chachamim of that generation. And there were a number of exceptions of those who were able to get by without being killed. One of those happened to have been the brother-in-law of Yanai HaMelech. Shimon ben Shetach's sister was married to Yanai HaMelech. So she decided to hide her brother, and she puts him in hiding somewhere, and there he is for the entire duration of this epidemic, of this terrible episode that took place. She hid her brother and never told her husband that Shimon ben Shetach was being hid by none other than his own wife. So, this is what was going on, but pretty much outside of Shimon ben Shetach, almost everyone else was murdered. And Yanai HaMelech did not have any rachmanis at all. He murdered pretty much the entire leadership of the Jewish community. And Yehoshua ben Prachya, who was one of the great leaders of the generation, realized that he's next. He realized they're going to come after him, and therefore he ran away to Alexandria, which was a major community in Egypt. So he goes to Alexandria, he figures, I'm going to stay there until things quiet down in Yerushalayim. And so he did. He stays there, and he's not to be found anywhere near the land of Israel, anywhere in Yerushalayim, until a number of years later he gets a letter from Shimon ben Shetach that it's time for him to return, that things have calmed down, and things are now in a place that is comfortable for him. And he encourages his friend Yehoshua ben Prachya to come back from Egypt and migrate back to Yerushalayim. Now, what happened when Shimon ben Shetach, how did he come out of his hiding? How did he come out of his cave? So the Gemara says, a pretty insane story. That's the only way you can describe it. The Gemara tells us that Yanai HaMelech at some point makes a banquet for all of his friends. And they're all sitting there and celebrating and enjoying themselves. And finally it comes time at the end of the banquet to bench, to say Birchas HaMazon. And one turns to the other and he says, we don't have anybody here who knows the words of Birchas HaMazon. What are we going to do? Now, it's surprising to me that that bothers you after you've just murdered every single leader of the Jewish community. But these are human beings. Sometimes human beings are a little bit strange in the way they think. And the Gemara tells us that Yanai HaMelech, although he had just finished murdering the entire leadership of the Jewish community, he's worried now, what are we going to do about Birchas HaMazon? So his wife turns to him and he says, don't worry, I have an answer. There's one person who I know of who I think might be helpful. He says, who is that? And she says, well, I'll only share the secret with you if you promise that you won't harm him, that you won't kill him. So he promises, because Birchas HaMazon is so important to him, and he promises that he's not going to harm this individual. And lo and behold, out comes Shimon ben Shetach from hiding, her brother. And he comes and he sits at the dais together with his brother-in-law, this murderer. And Shimon ben Shetach, the Gemara tells us, is the one who is honored, if you can say that, with the Birchas HaMazon at this party. And after that, Yanai HaMelech realizes he made a big mistake. And now things finally come down, and that's when Shimon ben Shetach invites his friend Yehoshua ben Prachya to come and join him back in Eretz Yisrael and join him back in the leadership in Yerushalayim. On his way back from Egypt to the land of Israel, the Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin that he stops off at an inn, and he was there without really much to his name. All he had with him was one student who was traveling with him. And the Gemara tells us that they had a woman who was the innkeeper there who took care of them. And she was such a gracious host. And she was so accommodating and so hospitable. And she was so thoughtful to them. And he makes a comment. Yehoshua ben Prachya turns to his student and he says, Kama na achsan yazu. How gracious is this host? She's such a nice woman. Look what she does for us. She doesn't know who we are. She's never met us before. And look how much she's willing to go out of her way. He happens to have one student who was with him, who we now know as Yeshu HaNotzri, the founder of Christianity. So he, at the time, was a student of Yehoshua ben Prachya. And he turns back to his teacher and he says, really, you're so impressed with this woman? He says, Eineha Trutos. There's something about her eyes that just is not very appealing. There's something about the way she looks that just is not very attractive to me. And Yehoshua ben Prachya turns to his student and he says, Bekach ata osek? Really? Is that what you're focusing on? After all that this woman has done for us, all you can look at is her eyes and figure out whether or not you're attracted or you're appreciating the way she looks? Really? Is that where your mind is? Is that where your focus is? And immediately Yehoshua ben Prachya is so embarrassed and he's so upset by the reaction of his student, he says that he takes out a shofar, the Gemara says, Vinida oso. He puts him in chayrim. He says, this is such unacceptable behavior, it's so inappropriate, you are now excommunicated from the Jewish community. That's what he does. Well, the Gemara tells us that we have a right to be very critical of the behavior of Yehoshua ben Prachya. And although there was something lacking in his student's response, but the Gemara says that Yehoshua ben Prachya should not have been so heavy-handed with his student, Yeshu HaNotzri. And the Gemara goes so far as to say, I'm sure many of us have heard of this line, La'olam tehe smol docha v'yamin mikareves. The Gemara says, yes, we need to make a balance as parents or as educators or as grandparents. How much ava and how much yira, how much discipline we give to our children and how much we need to just show them the abounding love that we have for them. And the Gemara says you always have to strike that balance. And the Gemara there tells us, Lo ki Yehoshua ben Prachya. Don't do like Yehoshua ben Prachya did, Shadachvo l'talmidav b'shtei yadayim, that he pushed away his students so heavily, and he was so adamant about his upset feelings and his embarrassment from the student and the response that he had, says the Gemara, don't act like that. That is not something that will yield a positive response. That is not something that will bring about anything good in the future. And therefore the Gemara says, learn from the mistake of Yehoshua ben Prachya. The Gemara is extremely critical of the way he behaved. However, the Gemara then goes on to tell us the tragic part of the story, and that is that Yeshu HaNotzri, after he was excommunicated, really has feelings of regret. He feels terrible about what it is that he did, and every day he comes back to his Rebbe and he asks him, are you willing to accept me back? Are you willing to forgive me? Are you willing to overlook what it is that happened? I feel terrible about what happened, and every day his Rebbe turns him away and says, no, I don't think that you're sincere enough. I don't think that it's time yet. I think time will heal, and we're just not prepared to have you back. One fine day, the Gemara says, Yehoshua ben Prachya was prepared to accept his student back. He thought it was the appropriate time, and he thought enough time had passed. However, the Gemara says, he was in the middle of saying Kriya Shema. And as he's saying Kriya Shema, his student, Yeshu HaNotzri, walks into the room, and he asks him, are you willing to accept me back? Are you willing to lift the ban against my communication with this community, with you? Yehoshua ben Prachya holds up his hand, meaning to say, wait a minute, I'm in the middle of saying Kriya Shema. Yoshua ben Prachya took that the wrong way, and he said, look, every day he's pushing me away with his hands, today must be no different, that's it, I'm finished. And from then the Gemara says, Yoshua ben Prachya went off on his own way, created his own religion, and decided to write the New Testament. Everything happened as a result of that story, because there was a misunderstanding of what his Rebbe meant to tell him that last day that he was willing to take him back. Now, the Gemara says, Yoshua ben Prachya then realizes, what a tragedy. What a tragedy did I just cause? Look what happened. And he sees that the movement of Yeshua HaNotzri is really gaining steam, and he was very concerned about it. And then he himself goes running after Yeshua HaNotzri, and he says, it's time to come back. I'm willing to accept you. It was all a mistake. And Yeshua HaNotzri says, didn't you teach us? Kalachote umachte esarabim ein maspikim biyad olasos tshuva? Didn't you teach us? I was in the shir that day. When you yourself taught us that somebody who goes ahead and does a certain level of sin, so much so that they convince others to fall so low and to do sin along with them, didn't you teach us in your teachings that we never accept such a person back and God will never accept their tshuva? Yeshua HaNotzri says, I've gone too far. It's impossible to turn around now. And that's the way the story ends. It's a very tragic story. Now, last time I mentioned the story, I got a number of emails from people who understand Jewish history, and they said, just the dates don't work out. How could it be that Yeshua HaNotzri, that the person who we expect to be the leader of Christianity, how can it be that he was a student of Yoshua ben Prachya? When, anybody here familiar with Jewish history a little bit? Okay, so when do we assume, it's not a good or bad question, it's just asking. So when do we assume that Christianity actually started? Anybody know in terms of Churban Beis HaMikdash? So there's a major discrepancy in the years about when exactly this happened. And the understanding of the Chachmei Umas HaOlam, the understanding of the rest of the world, is that Christianity really started up much later than this time. There's like a 150-year discrepancy between the time of Yeshua ben Prachya and the time that it is understood that this really happened based on the history as we know it. So this is a question that many people had emailed me, and the truth is, it is not their question. It is the question that is raised by many of the Rishonim. Some of them being the Ravid and the Meiri, and some very prominent Rishonim try to figure out, what do we do about this time gap? What do we do about the fact that there seems to be a 150-year discrepancy between the time that we assume that Yeshua HaNotzri actually got started, and the time that the rest of the world assumes that this got started? So the Ravid actually addresses this point, as well as a number of other Rishonim, and he says, Kosvei Zechronos Yisrael Omrim She Yehoshua Ben Prachya Hu Rabo Shel Yeshua HaNotzri. Our Gemara, our tradition has it that Yehoshua Ben Prachya was the teacher of Yeshua HaNotzri. Yeshua HaNotzri was the founder of Christianity. V'im Kain Hu Bimei Yanai HaMelech. That was in the days of Yanai, which was way before the days of the Churban Beis HaMikdash. However, he says, Kosvei Zechronos Umas HaOlam Omrim, the historians and the rest of the world, outside of the Chazal as we know it, they say, Ki bimei hurdus nolad, uvimei arkulus beno nidla. This happened 150 years later. So what's happening here, asked the Ravid. Machlokes gedolahi, he says, this is a major disagreement between our understanding of history and the rest of the world's understanding of the historical facts. And he says, Ahefrish gadol yesh beneam yoser mimea ve'eser shanim. It's about 110 years, 120 years, of a time lapse. And what do we do about that? And he says, after going through everything and looking at the history that the rest of the world claims and our history, he says, Misores emes yesh biyadenu min ashas. The truth is, whatever Chazal tell us. And writes the Ravid, I looked into the matter, and it's clear to me, after all the research that I did, that the dates are correct as we know it. That's what the Ravid says. And he says, Shelo echlifu shum davar, ki Yoshua ben Prachya baruch leMitzrayim bimei Alexander shehu Yanai, v'imo Yeshua HaNotzri v'kabalas emes biyadenu. We have a tradition that we believe is the correct one. That is the opinion of the Ravid. That is the way he understands this. There are others who assume that there were two Yeshua HaNotzris. It's a very easy way to answer the question. But whatever it is, it's really not the focus of our shir. Why do I mention the background of the story with Yoshua ben Prachya and Yeshua HaNotzri? It leads us into a comment of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. And Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky writes, as we started, why was this lesson so critical for the life of Yehoshua ben Prachya. I'm sure there were many insightful sayings that he taught throughout his lifetime. He was an educator. His whole life was about teaching. So why is it that he starts off and he says, Aseh lecha rav, this is so important, it's so fundamental. Why? Says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky as follows. Let's read it together, number Aleph. Yehoshua ben Prachya ra maiser v'nizkar halacha. Yehoshua ben Prachya learned this from the experiences of his own life. Ki halo haya rabo shel osa ha'isha yata letarbos ra. We believe, as we mentioned, that Yehoshua ben Prachya was the teacher of Yeshu HaNotzri. And look what happened after that tragic story of Yeshu HaNotzri. Achehim tzimi libo hosafa ala Torah. Yeshu HaNotzri went ahead and founded and created and fashioned his own religion as a result of his interaction with his teacher. V'hainu ha-Torah ha-Chadasha shebada milibo. This all came from himself. Avalim haya osa la'atzmo rav. Obviously, Yehoshua ben Prachya is to take some of the blame for the negative consequence, and the Gemara says that. However, writes Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, Yehoshua ben Prachya realized there was something lacking on the other end as well. And that is that the relationship between the student and his teacher was tremendously lacking. And that was something that made all of this happen. That was flawed. V'hainu mekabel maris rabo. If he only would have had a teacher that he really accepted the authority of, if he really only understood that his teacher was looking out for him and trying to guide him in the right path in life, ve'eino mahara acharav azhaya lo hayameiz lechadish davar shaloshama. How would he ever dare? If he had a relationship with his teacher that was one of respect, that was one of not scorn and ridicule, but one of admiration, would he ever have had the nerve, would he have ever had the audacity to move forward and develop and fashion his own religion? Writes Rav Shuv Yom Prachya, I learned from my experience that the most important thing is Aseh Lecha Rav at every stage in life. You need to have someone that you admire and respect, who you can always check in with, who can always be the one who is your sounding board. So I saw a comment of the Dubna Magid, where he writes in a Sefer on Chumash. We have a Mishnah later on in Pirkei Avos, I don't know if we'll ever get there, but it says, Im ein anili mili, ukshe anila atzmi ma ani. What does that line mean, ukshe anila atzmi ma ani? I think the basic understanding of that Mishnah is, if I think that everything in the world is only about me, and I am the only one who can accomplish something, and I don't appreciate and value the community that's around me and the friends that I have and the people that are able to help me go toward my dream, ma'ani, how will I ever be successful? I'm missing out in life. I think that's really what it means. But says the Dubna Magid, perhaps it means something so much more important than that and so much more profound, and I'll read you his words. Ki im ein la'adam moshel acher ki im mechiraso. If a person does not have in life some kind of guide, some kind of confidant, some kind of instructor or mentor, ki'im bechira, so if everything in my life is only leapt up to my understandings, my feelings and my intellect and my thoughts, and that's the way I make all of my decisions in life, and that is the way I direct my family, that's the way I direct all of the things that I desire to be involved in, humesukan me'atzmo. Says the Dubna Magid, you're in tremendous danger, because you cannot be objective. When you're only coming from your opinions, from your feelings, and from your thoughts, it's very difficult for a person to be critical of something that they think of on their own. Sometimes you have a great idea, you discuss it with your spouse, and they say you're out of your mind, in a respectful way. But sometimes we need that. We need to always have a person who's there, who we can trust, who can tell us when we're making a tremendous mistake. And therefore writes the Dubna Magid, Ein Adam Roa Chovela Atzmo. It's extremely difficult for a person to be detracting and to be critical of themselves. And very often we need that person in our lives to point out our flaws and to point out where we're making a mistake in the logic that we think is so sane and makes so much sense. Ki zechok hateva, writes the Dubna Magid, this is human nature. Asher ha'adam al atzmo, when a person is dealing with themselves. Hataiva matas hoso ad ki omer muter. I can have a desire to be involved in something. I can have a desire to be the richest person in my community. And therefore, I start to figure out ways of how I'm going to go about doing that, even if it means I'm going to steal from the government and I'm going to cheat other people that I do business with. And all of that gets lost in translation because I have an idea and all I want is to be the wealthiest man in the neighborhood. And I don't have an objective view of whatever it is that I'm making in my decision-making process. And sometimes that's what we need. We need somebody who is unprejudiced. We need somebody who is unbiased. We need somebody who's an outsider to look at whatever it is that we're doing and say, well, is this really something that makes sense? Is this a decision that is worth pursuing? Is this something that you should really be going after? Or is there a tremendous flaw in whatever it is that you've involved yourself in? That, says the Dubna Maggid, is what it means. Ukesha'ani la'atzmi ma'ani. If everything about my life is only about my beliefs, my conclusions, my ideas, my understandings and my theories, and I never have the decency and I never have the understanding to have somebody else who can examine what it is that I think is important, who can probe the ideas that I've had, who can carefully challenge and cross-examine whatever it is that I think is the right way of life, Ma'ani, where will I ever get in life, says the Dubna Maggid. What kind of life is that? And this is a tremendous challenge that we face. Writes Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, this is what it means, Aseh Lecha Rav. Aseh Lecha Rav, one needs to always make sure that they have somebody in their lives that can be that sounding board, that can be the person that will always be critical, not always, but can always have that critical eye on whatever it is that they do. And I learn from my own mistakes, says Yehoshua ben Prachya. It was something that was lacking in my own life. Because my student, Yeshua HaNozri, didn't have that. And as a result of him not having that relationship with me, look what happened as a result. Look at the outcome. Look how tragic a story this became as a result of the unhealthy relationship that he had. And sometimes this can happen to a person when you get some kind of promotion. I remember my father told me my first Shabbos in the White Shul. I was 26 years old or something. And I was embarrassed to be standing there in front of the entire shul. And my father called me after Shabbos and he said, how did it go? I said, you know, to tell you the truth, it was a little bit funny. So he said, why? I said, you know, they had me sit right next to Rabbi Pelkowitz, who at the time was in his 90s already. And he was a rabbi for over 60 years and a very successful one. And I'm sitting next to him. Across from me was Rabbi Feiner, who also had made a name for himself. And Rabbi Feiner and Rabbi Pelkowitz got up to introduce me to give a drasha that Shabbos. I said to my father, in the middle of Musaf, I had to turn around at the wall and just laugh at myself. And I said to him, I asked myself, what am I doing here? This is insane. And my father said to me, just always remember, the day you stop laughing at yourself is the day you need to get out of this position. And it was a very important comment that he made to me, because it's so easy to get lost. How many powerful people have we seen in the world, Jews and non-Jews alike, powerful politicians, who don't have to answer to anybody, and therefore get involved in things that are so corrupt and end up destroying their own lives, all because they just don't have that Aseh Lecha Rav, all because they don't have that person in their life who they know they need to answer to, who they know they need to be honest with. And that is so critical at every stage of life. We can be parents, we can be grandparents, we can be people who are big shots and CEOs of companies and rabbis and doctors and lawyers and everything. We always need to have Aseh Lecha Rav. It doesn't necessarily mean only a spiritual Rav. It means in general, in every aspect of life, we need to make sure that there's somebody who we know we need to answer to. And if we don't have that, life can so easily spiral out of control. This, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, is why Yehoshua ben Prachya taught us this first lesson before anything else. Aseh Lecha Rav. Because if you don't have that, you're going to live a life that is so misdirected, that is so complicated and so off track, and sometimes so confused. And this is a tremendous challenge that he himself had experienced in his own life. Now we have a comment of the Sefer HaChinuch. Sefer HaChinuch writes in the very end of his Sefer, we have a mitzvah, lo sasser min hadavar asher yagidu lecha yamin usmo. We have a mitzvah that we're supposed to listen to the Beis Din HaGadol. If they make a psak, if they issue a ruling, we have an obligation to accept it. Writes the Sefer HaChinuch, make no mistake. Don't think this is only talking about Moshe Rabbeinu. When he makes a ruling that we have an obligation to listen to whatever it is that he tells us to do, but writes the Sefer HaChinuch, and let's read it together. V'ha'over al zeh. Somebody who does not appreciate the value of this mitzvah. Somebody who doesn't understand the centrality of this mitzvah. Ve'eino shomea la'atzas ha'gedolim shebedora b'chachmas ha'torah. And you do not follow whatever it is that is the instruction of the leaders of your generation, not Moshe Rabbeinu, not the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, but the leaders of our generation, says the Sefer HaChinuch. This is a perpetual mitzvah. It has not stopped. And he says, somebody who doesn't understand that, mivatel aseizeh, he says, obviously you are not in fulfillment of this mitzvah that the Torah instructs us to do. Ve'onsho gadol miyod. Why is the punishment so severe? Shezeu ha'amud ha'chazak shahatorah nish'enesbo. Powerful statement of the Sefer HaChinuch. Shezeu ha'amud ha'chazak shahatorah nish'enesbo, because this is the anchor. This is the foundation. This is the pillar and the backbone of everything that our Torah stands for. That we have authority. That we have leadership. And that we as Jews need to take guidance from the leaders of our community. We have an extremely surprising Gemara Maseches Makos, where the Gemara there tells us about somebody who kills Bishogeg. So the Gemara gives the example that was relevant in their time. Somebody's chopping wood in a forest and the head of the axe, whatever that's called, falls off and it goes and kills someone. It's not a really relevant example today because we generally don't hear that story, but let's modernize the example. Somebody's driving a car and I'm following all the laws and I'm wearing my seatbelt and I'm going by the lights and I'm not speeding, and I'm doing everything as I'm supposed to do. And then somebody runs in the middle of the street, and I just cannot stop my car, and unfortunately they get run over, and they lose their life. Obviously it's not my fault. Obviously I'm not held responsible. Nobody's going to prosecute me. It was clear that the person violated the law, and I did nothing wrong. However, I am considered to be a rotzeach b'shogeg. I still murdered someone. It may not have been my fault, but I'm what we refer to as a rotzeach b'shogeg. And the Torah tells us that somebody who unfortunately is involved in a ritzicha b'shogeg needs to go to the Ari Miklat. They need to spend time in a community that is designated for all these kinds of people. That's what the Gemara says. However, the Torah says, when doing so, when sending a person to that designated city because they have been involved in an accidental murder, in a case like that, says the Torah, v'chei achicha imach. You cannot destroy his life. You have to make it comfortable for him there. This is not a punishment for him to be there. He didn't do anything wrong. The Torah says when he's a rotzeach b'shogeg, that's where he needs to go. And that community needs to have schools, and that community needs to have shuls, and that community needs to have hotels and houses and movie theaters and everything else that a regular community would expect to have. We need to have there as well, because v'chei achicha imach. We need to make life comfortable for that person while they are there. Says the Gemara. How far do we need to go in making life comfortable for that person? How extreme do we need to be? What do we need to do for them? Well, says the Gemara, Talmud Shagala, if you have a student of a yeshiva who unfortunately is involved in a ritzicha b'shogeg, and he now needs to be summoned to the Ir Miklat and he needs to stay there, Maglin Rabo Imo. Fascinating statement. So I'm the teacher. I'm completely innocent. I didn't teach him to run people over. I'm certainly not an active part of anything. I didn't even know about the story. I get a call that unfortunately a student now ran somebody over and has to go to the Ari Miklat. Says the Gemara, Maglin Rabo Imo. The teacher has to go to the Ari Miklat together with that student. Why? Because the Torah says, V'chei achicha imach. You have to make life comfortable for that person. You cannot destroy their lives when they go to the Ari Miklat. So the Rambam quotes the halacha and he expands on it a little, and listen to the words that he says. Number Gimel. Talmud shegala la'ari miklat maglin rabo imo shenemar v'chei. Asei lo kidei sheyichya. We have to do whatever it is that we can to make life comfortable for him, that he can actually move on. One second. V'chaye ba'le achachma, says the Rambam. Why is this so important? He says, because chaye ba'le achachma u'mevaksheha. Those who live life showing an interest in what the Torah represents and what a Torah life is all about, but you'll strip them away from Talmud, you'll strip them away from having that relationship with their teacher, writes the Rambam, Kimisa Chashuvin. You're killing that person. Says the Rambam, you're killing that person. And if the Torah says, V'chei achicha imach, it means you need to do whatever you can to make sure that their lives are going to be comfortable. So you'll ask, what about the rest of the students? And why is it fair to the teacher? All very good questions that I don't have the answer to. However, what I do know is that the Gemara does say very clearly, without anyone disagreeing, and the Rambam quotes it clearly, lahalacha, should we ever be faced with this unfortunate circumstance, we have the obligation to send the teacher along, because if not, kemisa chashuvin. It's like you're killing that person to take their authoritative figure away from them, to take their leader away and not give them the opportunity to interact with them, is something that would be too extreme and too unfair. There's a well-known medrash in Parshas Bo. And the medrash there tells us, based on the psukim, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chadashim, we know as Jews that we count a lunar calendar, we do not follow the solar calendar. And the question that many Mefarshim has asked is, why is it that the Jewish community follows a lunar calendar? After all, the lunar calendar is something that is not followed by the rest of the world. They follow the solar. But on top of that, the moon itself does not have any independent light, any radiance. All of its light comes as a reflection of the sun. Wouldn't it make more sense that the Jewish community that is eternal, that has been everlasting, should be compared to the sun? We've been around for a long time. We're pretty powerful. We've made tremendous contributions. So why is it that we compare ourselves to the moon as opposed to the sun? Many interpretations have been given, but one of them is, perhaps we can suggest that the moon is all about being a mekabel. The moon, all it does is, it receives light from the sun. It has no light on its own. And we have to learn as Jews to be submissive. We have to learn as Jews sometimes to be humble and to resign ourselves to the fact that, yes, we need to be deferential and we need to sometimes listen to those who are shining light onto us. And yes, it's difficult living in the age that we do, where there's autonomy and everybody has the opportunity to write whatever they want and to share whatever feelings they want, and there's freedom of speech and freedom of religion and freedom of everything and freedom of choice for whatever it is that we might want. But yet, we as Jews have an opportunity and an obligation to learn how to master this art of being a mekabel, of being a shomea, of being like the moon, of being like the yareach, who accepts so much from the sun and gives off nothing of its own. That perhaps is why the Jewish community has adopted the lunar calendar as opposed to the solar calendar. One of the arguments of Korach against Moshe Rabbeinu. Rashi there in Parshas Korach tells us that there were a number of arguments lobbied back and forth. But one of them seems to be very strange. I have many things, if I would get in a fight, Chalila, with Moshe Rabbeinu, I would have many things that I could bring to his attention that bothered me. We have an Aguna crisis today, right? I can talk to Moshe Rabbeinu and say, really? You couldn't figure out how to get around this problem? Does this make sense? We have women who are suffering for so many years just because their crazy husbands won't take care of giving them a get. Really, is that reasonable? Does that make sense? And in Israel, they'll throw the man in jail for years, and there's just no way around it. Really? I have many questions I can ask Moshe Rabbeinu. But Korach chooses very carefully what it is that he wants to challenge Moshe Rabbeinu with. What does he say? One of the arguments he makes is, we all know that there's a mitzvah for a man to wear tzitzis. But it's a twofold mitzvah. You're supposed to wear tcheles and lavan. They're supposed to be blue strings and white strings. So Korach says, really? Is it important to always have the tcheles strings along with the white? I mean, come on, Moshe Rabbeinu. Is that really so important? I would say, if you take the entirety of Torah, this would be below the lowest question that I would ask Moshe Rabbeinu. What does it bother him that we wear tcheles and lavan? I mean, what's the issue here? Why is that so offensive to Korach Va'adaso? Why is that the choice that he decides to challenge Moshe Rabbeinu about? Tcheles and lavan, it should be all white. What do we need the blue for? What is the resemblance in his question? What is he trying to represent? So Rav Soloveitchik writes so beautifully. My father has it in his Sefer Nefesh HaRav, where he suggests the following. Let's read it together, just the beginning. B'machloges Korach V'Moshe Rabbeinu. Is it possible to fulfill the mitzvah of tzitzis without putting in the blue strings? We obviously adopt the opinion of Moshe Rabbeinu that Tcheles is necessary all the time. What is this all about? Suggests Rav Soloveitchik, Dehalavan Shebechute HaTzitzis, Misamel Osam HaInyanim Shemuchuvarim Etzleinu. White is purity. White is clarity. Like the Gemara says, we have a pasuk, when you have a court case, and there's a lack of clarity amongst the judges, and we don't know exactly who's right or who's wrong, we invite in the Edim, we invite in the witnesses, and we say, Uparsu Hasimla, and they should just spread out the sheet, the white sheet. What does it mean, spread out the white sheet? What evidence do you have on the white sheet? The answer is, they should just make it clear to us. It's a way of speaking. So white always represents clarity. Moshe Rabbeinu understood. There are parts of our lives, there are aspects of life that are clear, that are straightforward, that are obvious. However, HaTcheles, when we talk about the blue strings, what is that representative of? Shadom Elokisei Akava, the Gemara says that the blue strings are supposed to remind you of esoteric things, of God, of the Kisei Akavod, of the Shamayim, of the heavens. Misamelas, and that represents the Bilti Yodua, the obscure and the ambiguous parts of life that are not so clear to us. V'habilti Muvan Lanu. What was the thrust, what was the crux of Korach's claim, of his challenge against Moshe Rabbeinu? Korach ta'an, shekol ha'eda kulam kedoshim. Korach claimed, all of us heard the word of God from our Sinai. Everything is clear to all of us as it is clear to you, Moshe Rabbeinu. There is nothing in our life that is like Tcheles. There is nothing in life that makes us come to you, Moshe, for any guidance. Because everything in life is straightforward. Everything is simple. Everything is white. Let us get rid of the Tcheles parts of our lives because we don't want to believe in that. Kol ha'eda kulam kedoshim umadua tisnasu al kahal Hashem. Why do you, Moshe and Aaron, think that it's your place to be on top of the Jewish people and to field our questions? We don't need your leadership. We don't need your authority. We'll do okay without it. That was the claim of Korach va'adaso. V'davar zeh ratza Korach la'akor. You go further down. This is exactly what Korach wanted to wreak havoc in the Jewish community. And he said, she'ein tzorech l'rebi lifshot zvei kosav. We don't need a teacher. We can figure everything out on our own. Ve'ein tzorech tamid lishol etzal Moshe Rabbeinu. We don't need to have guidance from Moshe Rabbeinu or from the leaders of our generation today. Moshe Heshev, and Moshe responded to him and he said, you have it all wrong. There are going to be parts in everyone's life that are not going to be so black and white, that are not going to be so clear and so straightforward. And there is a need for all of us at every stage of our lives to have somebody that we can trust, to have somebody that we can rely on who we know will give us that sense of clarity that we so badly need. That is what the story, that was at the crux, that was the gist of the disagreement between Moshe Rabbeinu and Korach. Do we all have the obligation as Jews to always be that makabel? To always be that person who understands that there's a greater understanding of God's will than the way I see it. That the Ratzon Hashem is not always so simple, and that we need to take guidance from our authoritative figures who lead our communities. So Rav Soloveitchik has another very beautiful piece, if you turn the page. Rav Soloveitchik, there are comments on a pasuk in Sefer Bereishis. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu created man, we're told, Zeh Sefer Toldos HaAdam. V'yom bara Elokim Adam midmus Elokim asa oso. It says that we were all created B'Tselem Elokim. What does B'Tselem Elokim actually mean? Anyone know? Not a trick question. Not so clear. The Rishonim are not so clear. What is the Tselem Elokim? Is it the fact that we have the ability to speak? Is it the fact that we have a neshama? So let's just adopt that opinion that some Rishonim say, that our Tselem Elokim is the fact that we have a piece of God inside of us, that we have a neshama tahora that we speak about every morning in our davening. Neshama shenasata b'tahorihi, that is my Tselem Elokim. That is the way I resemble God Himself because He gave me a piece of Him, as amazingly otherworldly as that sounds. So here the Torah describes the Tselem Elokim. The next words are, Zachar unekeva bera'am. God created man as a male and a female. So ask many mefarshim, does that fit here? We're talking about the Tselem Elokim that we've all been created with, about our neshama. What is the relevance to the fact that some people's anatomy is male and others are females, that your DNA is like this and my DNA is like that? How does that fit into the discussion here? Zachar and Akeva Bara'am is a totally different description of what man is all about, and it does not seem to fit at all with what the Torah was just describing about our Tzelem Elohim. Suggests Rav Soloveitchik, perhaps what it means is that when we talk about human beings, we don't just look at the anatomy of a person and say, this is a Zachar, this is an Akeva, he's a man, she's a woman. No. When we talk about the spiritual side of a human being, there is also a Zachar Unakeva component. When we talk about the neshama that we have, about the aspirations that we have spiritually, we also need to appreciate this aspect of Zachar Unakeva. What does that mean? Rav Soloveitchik writes, it means, very often, a Nakeva is described as the Mekabel, and a Zachar is described as the Nosing. As we know, the male contributes sperm, and the female accepts it and makes it into something very special. The woman often is referred to as the Mekabel. Says Rav Soloveitchik, when we talk about spiritual life, we need to all recognize that we have two components that we are expected to live by spiritually. We have to contribute, and we have to be a part of all that goes on spiritually, and we have to do as much as we can aggressively to make our relationship with God strong. But we also need to understand that in order to do that effectively, we need to all be a Nekeva as well. To really get to what the Ratzon Hashem is, to really understand what does God actually want from me, how does He want me to live life, I have to be a little bit submissive. I have to be willing to put myself back a little bit and say, I'm going to accept what others tell me is the right way to serve God. It's not always left to me. It's not always the Zachar personality inside of us that is the driving force. Yes, there are many things in Judaism that we would like to have our way. And there are many other ideas that we think should be the way we envision God's religion actually playing itself out. But that's where our Nekeva personality needs to come in. We turn to our leaders. Every aspect of life has tcheles and lavan. It's complicated. And we need to have that understanding, writes the Sefer HaChinuch, that without this, we have no foundation of what Torah is all about. We cannot serve God properly. Because it's all about understanding the importance of the leadership role that we need to have in our communities, and the understanding that we as followers need to have, and the relationship that is developed between the Aseh Lecha Rav and the student who has chosen that teacher, whoever it might be. That, writes Rav Soloveitchik, is what this is all about. Now, many have argued that in today's generation, there really is no longer any reason for authority. And many have challenged rabbinic authority today. After all, we live in a generation which is very blessed, where we have so much information that is so readily available. And we have unlimited, unrestricted access. We can find anything we want. You just Google a question, you'll find online somebody that says something about it at this point. And many have argued that therefore, in the age of autonomy, where we have so much ability to educate ourselves, why do we need this leadership? Why do we need this kind of authoritarian figure on top of us that's going to tell me what to do? It's a good question. This is a lot for anyone that's following current events, a lot of what's going on in Teaneck this week, unfortunately. A major debate, a major discussion. Okay, we don't need to get into it. But it happens often in halachic discussions today that are very sensitive issues, where there's a conversation that takes place where the leaders of a community unequivocally share their opinion and say the way the Jewish community should go, and which direction and which path they should go in. And the followers decide that this is a democratic process. And I have a right to write articles and to convince the public that because I've researched the topic, I have just as much a say as the leaders of the community. This is a major problem. Right? What? Yesh v'yesh. That's why we're not getting into that discussion itself, but I think this is a major problem in general. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, 35 years ago, actually tries to tackle the issue. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, if he wrote it 35 or 40 years ago, when there was not this explosion of information that we have today. This is way before the internet and way before the access that we all have today to educate ourselves. Reb Moshe writes it then, and it is 100 times more true today. Let's see what Reb Moshe writes. We'll read it together. Gam amarti, sha'av kisheika ha'mefarshim harabim shechibru gedolei olam mikol ha'dor shelefaneinu. Yes, it is true. You go into a Jewish library and you find that there are hundreds and thousands of books, and you can educate yourself on pretty much any topic in the world, and you can find a book that is designated to whatever topic you want to learn. Yes, that is true, writes Reb Moshe. Still, he says, Tzarech le'rav gadol muvak sheyilmad. There is still a need for a teacher. Why? I think it's a good question. Why? I can read the books like my teacher can read the books. What do I need it for? Writes Reb Moshe, the need for it is Eich lehavin ulahaskil divrei raboseinu hamefarshim haposkim. You have to understand the context of what it is that you're reading. And that's something that requires somebody who has a far greater understanding of the panoramic view of whatever it is that the question that we are all facing right now. So take for example, I've discussed this issue in many different variations with Reb Asher Weiss, because it comes up every year or two with a different issue that the Jewish community is confronted with, and I've discussed many of them with him. And the example that he's told me on many occasions is the following. Over the last number of years, there's been a major debate about egalitarian minyanim. Can women get an aliyah? Can women not get an aliyah? Okay, a major discussion. I'm not suggesting that we should, but it's a major discussion that's been discussed universally. Okay. What is a major foundational claim that those who believe this is acceptable behavior, what is the foundation of their claim? What source do they have to this kind of practice? So they have, there's a siddur by Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, make no mistake, was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, and he was incredibly recognized and universally understood. He's not an outliner. He's a real personality in the halachic process. Rabbi Yaakov Emden has a siddur. And there's a footnote in the small print in the siddur where he suggests, perhaps, that women can get an aliyah. Okay. So what's wrong? So you put forth that argument. Are you questioning Rabbi Yaakov Emden? Do you think you're greater than him, and therefore you think that you have a right to say that what he wrote is wrong? No. So the way Reb Asher Weiss explained it to me is the following. 50 years ago, what did it take for a person to get to that footnote of Rabbi Yaakov Emden? Think about it this way. You probably mastered all of Tanakh with all of the Mefarshim. And after you spent 5 years doing that, you then went on to Mishnayos. Then you spent the next 20 years of your life mastering Gemara. After you knew all of Gemara and Shas Baal Peh, and you knew all of Mishnayos and all of Tanakh, you then moved on to Shulchan Aruch. And you spend the next 10 years of your life mastering the Shulchan Aruch with all the Nosi Kelim. After you've done that, you moved on to the Tshuvas Rebbe Kiva Eger and the Chasam Sofer, and now, after spending 35 years of your life, you finally come to the one Sefer you have left, which is Rabbi Yaakov Emden Siddur. And you see on the bottom of the page that there's a footnote there that says that maybe a woman can get an aliyah. But because you have the context of everything else that you've learned, you understand that that is not an opinion that is to be accepted. Does this make sense? No? It doesn't make sense? What about that argument doesn't make sense? Now we have so much information. Yes, of course, you can find anything. But if you look in the broader context of Yiddishkeit, and you've learned all of Shas, and you've learned all of Shulchan Aruch, and you know that until that point there is nobody else that indicated what Rabbi Yaakov Emden might say, you know that his opinion is not to be accepted. Of course, he's a legitimate opinion. And of course, his opinions are accepted in many other areas of halacha. However, when it comes to this, if you have the broader context and you understand how the development of halacha actually happened, you would understand intuitively that this is not something to hang your hat on. That, writes Reb Moshe, is the challenge. That is the challenge when we live in an age where everything is so accessible, where everything is so available, where we do have unlimited access to so many Jewish texts and we can all educate ourselves, but sometimes, he writes, what's missing is the context. And we don't understand how this fits in to the broader picture of what halacha expects of us, what Ratzon Hashem is in general. That takes an authoritative figure, a leader who has spent his entire life understanding what the fundamentals are and what the context of this entire picture really is all about. Happy to talk about that later offline if anyone has questions about that, but I think it's a very powerful point. and I think it's quite obvious. I'm happy to discuss again later. I have no problem discussing it. Not afraid of this issue. But I think that this is a extremely sensitive point that Rav Moshe raises. And then look at the end that Rav Moshe writes. The end of this paragraph, he says, V'chein yiyeh le'olam. This is the way it has been, and this is the way it's going to be for all eternity. Af kisheyavo melech ha-mashiach v'yichyu ha-mesim. Writes Rav Moshe. Even when we live in a time in Jewish history when things are clear to us, and we're going to have Tchiyas ha-mesim and Mashiach, v'lo yishtakach shum davar mimash ha-nischadish ha-rata. And we will have that sense of clarity, still writes Rav Moshe. We will then still have the need, od yiyeh mima lilmod ulechadesh od harbe yoser. We will still have the need for leaders. We will still have the need for people to explain to us how it is that we should behave and how the Jewish community should direct themselves. So the Pachad Yitzchak, Rav Huttner, has an amazing letter. I didn't put it on here, but he writes that he made an observation. In many major communities all around the world, Rav Huttner says, you'll notice that there's a clock tower. So we're all familiar with the Big Ben in London and in Ottawa. They also have this famous Peace Tower. Many towers all over the world, they have clock towers. Amazing sights. So Rav Huttner said, he observed, isn't it strange that the clock is all the way on top? Wouldn't it make more sense for the clock to be here in the middle of the street that I didn't have to look up into the sun and, you know, if I wasn't wearing my glasses that day, I couldn't see? Wouldn't it make sense if we put the clock right in the middle of the street somewhere so that everybody who passed by would be able to see? And he says there are two reasons that he understood as to why it is that the clock needs to be on top. And he writes the following. Number one, practical consideration. What if you're a person that lives on the outskirts of the city and you just don't pass by these streets? So you'll never know the time? Writes Rav Huttner, this is why we put it in a position which is so high up, where everybody, wherever you happen to live in the neighborhood, you'll be able to see what time it is. But number two, he says, let's try to play out the scene if this clock was in the middle of the street. So they would put the clock down, the first person would walk by, and he'd say, no, that's the wrong time. And he would switch the clock to be like his watch. Next person would walk by and say, no, that's not right. He's going to switch it back 2 minutes. And it's going to keep on going back and forth. And we will never know the accurate time. Because everybody thinks that they have to modify it to the clock that they have. Everybody thinks that they are right. And everybody is totally convinced that the time that I have and the understanding of time that I have must be right because I'm living the perfect life. And I have to just adjust the rest of the world to be understanding like me. Writes Rav Huttner, that is the challenge that we have today with leadership. It's the challenge that we have because so often, he says, the clock, that leader that we're supposed to be looking up to, unfortunately, we put them right in the middle of the street. And everybody walks over to them and says, well, I just have to adjust it a little bit. I just have to modify, I just have to adapt the way you understand this to the way that I think life should be lived. Not realizing that that person, it doesn't mean they shouldn't be in touch with the community. They obviously need to be. They need to understand the realities of the community that they live in. And they need to understand very well and full well the challenges of their time. However, they also need to understand that leadership means you cannot just modify and adapt everything based on all the Facebook posts that you read, based on all the articles that you might read in the newspaper. That is not the way that the halachic process is going to work. The halachic process is one where we look to our leaders for guidance and for clarity in all of the issues that confront our communities. This is not a democratic process. So we have a story, the Gemara in Yevamos Daf Mem Zayin. And with this, we'll get closer to closing. So the Gemara in Yevamos Daf Mem Zayin, there's a lot more to say, but the Gemara there tells a story about Rus and Naomi. And there the Gemara tells us that when Rus was about to convert, her mother-in-law Naomi presented her with a number of questions. Are you really prepared to do this? Does it make sense for you? And one of the questions that she asked is, are you prepared to observe the laws of Tchum Shabbos? Now, it would seem to be an unusual question. If you had a potential convert, and you had a list of questions that you would think about asking them, are you sure you want to be Jewish? Do you understand that Taras HaMishpacha is not so easy? Do you understand that keeping Shabbos is a tremendous challenge? Do you understand that not speaking Lashon Hara is something that many of us have difficulty with? I would ask some of those questions. I don't think Tchum Shabbos would be the question that I would present. First of all, How often on Shabbos do you actually take a walk and you're potentially walking outside of the Tum? It can happen, but for most of us, it's not that often that the question comes up. Number two, the Gemara says the laws of Tum Shabbos are only midrabbanan. It's not even a biblical prohibition. So why is Rus and Naomi, why are they getting caught up with this issue of Tum Shabbos? Why is that so important? It seems to be so inconsequential in the greater picture of what Taryag Mitzvahs is all about. Writes the Kli Chemda, in order to understand this, we need to take ourselves back to Parshas Yisro. So we have that sublime experience when God comes down on Har Sinai and He gives us the Torah and He gives us the first Dibros, and it's amazing and everyone's passing out. It's an unbelievable experience. Writes the Kli Chemda, as beautiful an experience as we picture it, the Medrash tells us that we were actually not God's first choice. It says that God went to all the other nations of the world and He asked them first if they would want to accept the Torah. And what happened? So we'll just give one example. The Medrash says He went to the children of Esav and He asked them if they would like to accept. They asked God, what does it say in the Torah? God says, Lo Sirtzach. They said, what do you mean? Achar b'chatichya. This is our essence. This is what we're all about. And therefore, we cannot accept the Torah. Okay, the same story played itself out, one nation to the next, till finally He comes to the Jewish people. Nasav and Ishma, wonderful, we got a deal. Har Sinai, got the Torah. God loves us. Ask the Kli Chemda. That's the short story. Ask the Kli Chemda. Really? Are we deserving of so much credit? After all, he says, don't we know? Maybe the reason why all the other nations of the world did not accept is because there was something fundamental in the Torah that was against their very essence. They had a predisposition to murder. You're asking me, Lo Sirtzach? It's impossible for me. Ask the Kli Chemda, what was the challenge for the Jewish people? Where did God say to us, let me see, if you're willing to overcome this, then I'll take you. Maybe there was nothing that was against our natural predisposition. God asked us, do you want to keep Shabbos? Sure, why not? It's beautiful, it's great, a day off. Of course we'll do that. So, what was it that God put to the challenge for the Jewish people to see if they were actually willing to overcome it, to accept His Torah? Writes the Kli Chemda in the name of the Ger Rebbe, the Chedushi Harib. He says, you look at the Pesukim before Kabbalah Satorah and you'll notice there was one instruction that we were given. And that is, Hagbel Eshaha. God tells Moshe Rabbeinu, you have to put fences around the mountain, and only you and the Shivim Zakenim are going to be allowed these special access onto the mountain, but everybody else has to stay down below. That was the challenge that was given to the Jew at the time of Kabbalah Satorah. God wanted to know, do we have the ability to say, I'm confident and I'm comfortable standing at the bottom of the mountain when Moshe Rabbeinu himself is going to be the one standing on top, and I am not allowed to go there. That was the one instruction we were given before Kabbalah Satorah happened. And God wanted to see, yes, it's against your nature, because a Jew's nature is to be aggressive. A Jew's nature is that I always want to be closer, and I always want to be the one who's closely connected with God. It comes from a good place, of course it does. But God challenged us and He says, if you want to accept my Torah like the Sefer HaChinuch that we started with, you need to understand that this is a basic fundamental for everything that the Torah is about. Hagbel Asahar. Torah is about understanding our limitations. It's about understanding there are places we belong, there are places that we don't. There are vacations that we go on, there are vacations that we don't. There are places that we're allowed to eat, there are other places that we cannot eat. There are places that we belong, inserting ourselves into the conversation, and there are others that we need to realize, this is a discussion for Moshe Rabbeinu v'chaveirav, and we need to stay at the bottom of the mountain. That, writes the Chedushi Harim, was the challenge given to the Jews, and yet they were willing to overcome that. God says, now I accept you as my people. That, says the Kli Chemda, is what Naomi was trying to impress upon Rus. It's not about Tchum Shabbos. It's about understanding that everything that a Jew does in life has to be with the clear appreciation of boundaries and limits. That's what a Jew is all about. It's about knowing there are places we belong and places that we don't. There are things we can eat and things that we cannot. There are conversations that we belong in and conversations that we do not. And the Gemara says in Masechet Shabbos Kuf Yud Tes, Alma Chorva Yerushalayim. So I'm sure we have read many, many different passages in Chazal about why it is that Yerushalayim was destroyed. But let me share with you the comment that the Gemara says about why it is that we lost Yerushalayim. Not because of Avodah Zarah, Gila Arayis, and Shvichas Damim, but rather, says the Gemara, L'charva Yerushalayim ela al shehishvu katan v'gadol. Yerushalayim was destroyed. There was a breakdown in Jewish community because we lost our appreciation for Jewish authority. Shehishvu katan v'gadol. What does it mean? It means that we were no longer able to distinguish, to differentiate between the eminent and the ordinary. We were no longer able to distinguish between the renowned and the nameless. We lost the appreciation for what it means to be a leader of the Jewish people because everybody said, I can be the leader. Says the Gemara, that caused the breakdown of Yerushalayim. That says Yoshua ben Prachi in our Mishnah, if you want to lead a successful Jewish life, number one, I learned from my own experience, Asei Lecha Rav. You need to have people in your life who are authoritative figures who you know you need to answer to. And if you don't have that, look how much tragedy can result in that kind of deficiency in the relationship between the community and its leaders. That is why Yoshua ben Prachia taught this as the very first lesson that he wanted to transmit to all future generations. Because he said, I've seen what can happen when we don't make sure to have that. I've seen how much of a breakdown it can cause when unfortunately we don't have that healthy relationship between teacher and student and teacher. And that, writes the Sefer HaChinuch, is something that is the yesod, the foundation of what Judaism is all about. So Amir Tzashem.